This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds is going to finish up his second consecutive term of office at the end of next year. And according to state statute, he cannot serve more than two consecutive terms. So there is somebody who is waiting in the wings, quite literally, that is very interested in running for sheriff in Porter County. It's Sheriff Reynolds' son, David II. And he is with us to talk about his decision to run as a candidate for county sheriff next year. David, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's not often that you get a chance to talk to not only the son of a Porter County sheriff, but someone who is interested in taking over the job. Not that you're not qualified. You have almost 20 years of experience in law enforcement. And tell us more about yourself and why you're interested in running for sheriff.
Well, I'm interested for a few reasons, but, you know, my experience started in college in law enforcement. I had the pleasure to attend Indiana University in Bloomington, and they have a unique program there where, as a student, you can work as a police officer. So I actually went to the police academy when I was 20 years old and then finished up my degree at IU and worked there as a police officer before being hired by the sheriff's department. So I worked there for about 5 years, and then while I was at the sheriff's office, I applied for a position as a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration, where I worked for approximately 15 years before deciding to do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you worked in the Chicago office of the DEA, right?
I did. You know, so when you go to DEA, you get hired, and they don't tell you which city you are reporting to after graduation. So I was lucky enough, to be honest with you, I was single at the time, didn't have a family, and I didn't even put in for Chicago. I thought it was an opportunity to go elsewhere, but I was they selected me to go to Chicago, and that's where I reported after graduating, and it was great. It was a wonderful experience. I had worked with some really, really great teams and some great supervisors, and just a lot of mentors that just were just really great in explaining, you know, really how not only drug trafficking works in Chicago, but, you know, the international piece and the gang piece locally as well.
Now, when you're involved in something such as the Drug Enforcement Administration, and you get to learn literally on the job, and as well as your experience from college as well in such matters of law enforcement, what did you pick up in particular by working with the DEA that you know that is going to definitely help you out here working in Porter County if you're elected?
Well, I think more than anything, Chris, I think it's the access to illegal drugs. You know, I think, you know, even when I worked at the sheriff's department, there were times we had narcotics cases, and I worked with the local drug unit here for a period, and was actually assigned to the Drug Enforcement Administration in Maryville for a few years. So I had an idea, but Chicago just gives a different scope of how massive these, you know, criminal organizations are and the reach that they have and how sophisticated they are. So I was fortunate enough to work some very long-term sophisticated cases that, you know, use wiretaps and other strategies that I think, you know, we can use here in Porter County, and different connections that I made while working those types of cases. And, you know, the importance of working with other agencies, I think, is something that, you know, I think is done here to some degree, but I think we can expand that. And that really was something I learned more than anything is, you know, this isn't a thing about stats or who gets credit. It's more of, you know, how can we collaboratively, you know, work these investigations to make sure that we're doing it effectively and efficiently. And I think that's something that I learned that the DEA does, you know, really as well as anybody in law enforcement. I mean, they are really known for their ability, you know, to work with different agencies, working with agencies, you know, different offices within DEAs. For example, you might have a case that takes you to Indianapolis, or it might take you to Los Angeles, or it might take you to Columbia or Europe. So, you know, it's that kind of thinking, I think, that will help, you know, bring some of those philosophies here to the sheriff's office.
Was it the problem that still exists in Porter County with drug overdoses and illegal use of drugs that that you experienced during the time that you were working as a deputy with the sheriff's department that got you further interested in getting involved in the DEA?
It did, Chris. And, you know, I think, you know, as we can see the trends with, you know, heroin overdoses, and now that fentanyl is becoming readily available, and, you know, it's obviously impacted the number of overdoses we see in Porter County specifically. You know, that is a problem. And, you know, I'm a parent, and I have nieces and nephews that live in this county and neighbors. And, you know, I'm a lifelong resident of Porter County, and it scares me. It scares me that heroin is and fentanyl is becoming more and more of a problem, and we need somebody, I think, with my background and my experience and knowledge to how to, develop different strategies or, different options how to reduce the demand for heroin. And, is that through prevention, treatment, and things like that. But, there's a law enforcement side of it, and I think that we always have to have that element where people don't want to sell drugs in Porter County because they think they're going to be charged with crimes, and that's something I think I can bring.
I understand, too, that you had an opportunity, along with working with the Porter County Sheriff's Department, I guess before you actually got into working with the DEA, to actually work for the Valparaiso Police, which, of course, is where your family live right now. Did that show some interest and kind of help bring you along in your education in law enforcement?
So I never worked for the Valpo City. I worked for the Sheriff's Department, and then I was hired right from the Sheriff's office right to DEA. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never worked with the city. I do live in Valpo. But no, I only worked at the sheriff's office locally.
Okay. Now that you have shown your interest and you've become at least a candidate in the Democratic primary election coming up next spring for the job of Porter County Sheriff, and you mentioned that about your experience working with the DEA and experience that you had working with the sheriff's department in some capacity in the past. What were some of the things, aside from your familiarity, certainly with law enforcement, and that goes also to your dad, who's been, of course, a longtime law enforcement officer before he ran for sheriff and is finishing up his second term. What is it in particular that you like in turn being able to turn all that into experience working with the community?
Well, even though I left the sheriff's office, I've always had a close connection with the department, what was happening there. There were several times where we would pass information, even with my job at DEA, to the sheriff's office. So I've always had, even though I left and I technically don't work there, I've always had a connection with the sheriff's office. Some of my closest friends in life, just happened to work at the sheriff's office. So, I have that. I think it's a sense of, being familiar with the department and the agency, but it's the part of the community that they're a part of. If that makes sense. So, mm-hmm. The sheriff's office has wonderful people and dedicated members of law enforcement that, coach their kids in different sports. They're, involved in, different aspects of their community. I mean, they're really, really great people. And I think, in the last several years, law enforcement has been painted in a certain light and, understandably so in some situations, but the reality of it is the sheriff's office has great people that work there, from the support staff to the rookie policemen. So that's something that I've always been proud of being a member of, and I'm excited with the idea of getting back there.
Now, you had your opportunity after leaving DEA to be able to spend some time certainly working in the community and talking with people as you are, making your decision that you finally, I guess, you got your paperwork filed back in the end of October. The official announcement, I guess it was I don't know if it was prematurely or not, but I'm sure that you don't mind Dad telling everybody that you're interested in running as sheriff. But the idea is that you had a chance to meet with people and to talk about the issues and get some ideas from them, didn't you?
I did. And, he's excited. And that's it's hard to, I know you know him. And, he's passionate about the sheriff's office and he wants to leave this, leave old place that he's worked so hard for in good hands. And, before I made this decision, I talked to, business owners and public officials and union leaders and people in the community. And really, regardless of backgrounds or, even their political beliefs, everyone here wants to keep, Porter County a safe place to live, do business, and raise their families. And that's why I decided to do this. I have a lot of respect for the institution, for the sheriff's office, the men and women that work there in the community. And if I didn't think I was qualified and the best person to do this, I wouldn't do it. So, to me, it's really that simple.
You had an opportunity to officially kick off your campaign running for county sheriff, I guess, November 2nd. That was an event that happened at the Sunset Hill Farm County Park. What was the reaction from folks that showed up for that event? And what have you heard so far from residents in Porter County about your running for sheriff?
It's been very supportive. you know, it's the first time I've done anything like that politically. So there is a degree of, you know, fear that five people will show up, and you're really scared that that's going to happen. But mm-hmm. you know, fortunately, we had a great turnout. We had a lot of people from all different walks of life, which was great. It wasn't just the law enforcement members or elected officials. It was friends, family, neighbors, you know, people that, you know, different political backgrounds, and people are excited. And, you know, I think, you know, more than anything, they want to make sure that we keep the sheriff's office running, you know, the way that it is. And, you know, people there thought or and think that I'm the person to make that happen.
I know the official filing for the primary election doesn't officially happen, at least until January 5th. But since you made your intents very well known and has been very public, what's in the works between now and the time that you can actually go to the Porter County Courthouse and officially file?
Well, I'm just going to continue to talk to people in the community, which has been great. You know, even before I decided to leave government service, I went back to grad school. So I'm finishing up my last semester of mm-hmm. my graduate work, which has been great. And then, you know, I coach both my son and daughter in different sports. So, you know, it's been just wonderful to be with them and my wife, obviously. So yeah, I'm very fortunate. I'm lucky in so many different ways of life, not just, you know, work wise or now entering into this race. And I'm not going to lose sight of that. So I'm just going to continue to talk to people, spend as much time with the family as possible, and, you know, just get this thing going.
And I guess that also means that you're going to follow through, obviously, after your official filing and right up until the primary election day, right?
That's correct.
It's going to be great to be able to get out there and meet with people in Porter County again, I'm sure, and meet new people that you've never met before. They're going to be curious as to what David Reynolds second is like. And if some people that know your dad will go, certainly, and if they don't already know about you, they're going to learn as well, too. That's a great opportunity to spread yourself out even more.
That's right. And, you know, the reality of it is, you know, we have the same name, but really our background is different, you know. You know, I worked as a federal agent, and, you know, he's obviously already had the job. And, you know, I think it's important, as you said, is for people to, before they come up with a determination of what they think, is to look at, you know, my resume, my experiences, and get to know me, hopefully, and learn about, you know, what I can bring to the sheriff's office.
David Reynolds II is the son of Porter County Sheriff David Reynolds, who is currently in office. And David Reynolds II has announced that he is going to run for Porter County Sheriff next year. He'll make his official filing here after the first of the year when he's able to do so. And the campaign is going to continue up until that time and beyond, until the May Democratic Party election. Thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck to you. And we hope to hear more from you in the months ahead, coming up to the primary election.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Greg Ellis is a published author. He is also a TV director, and he is, among other things, an Emmy Award-nominated actor. And now he is unfortunately involved in the real-life drama that he was not expecting. And he's written a book about it. And the book's entitled The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. And it's available by Kohler Books. It is out in publication now. And we have Greg to talk with us about not only the book itself, but also about the issues that you're championing right now, which is really making some major reforms in the family court situation around the country. Greg, thank you for being with us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I know that the book is a very, very, it's very scary for many places to some, certainly a very, very difficult subject to talk about or even to read for many, but it's a very eloquent way to portray life inside the family law system because of the issues that unfortunately you faced, and you're able to publish it in the book. And in particular, it deals with an issue that sometimes comes up and people forget about, that we talk about issues involving divorce, making it maybe safer, more equitable for women. But we seem to forget about fathers and men in general. How did this issue of this inequity seem to come about?
Well, really, it was the inequity in the system is, how long do you have? We could talk about that for a long time and how it came about because of the various laws and the interpretations of those laws over decades. My personal situation, I had no knowledge. I didn't even know the words family law till it hit me. In the span of 24 hours, I was ushered from my home in handcuffs institutionalized and incarcerated, first of five times, subjected to a temporary restraining order in a divorce court on the basis of a false allegation and became homeless, almost destitute overnight. And I think it speaks to the bigger picture, this false allegation. Through the simple 10-word false allegation, my life was turned upside down and ruined. But my son's lives, and that they were the meaning of my life, their lives were incalculably affected at the ages of 10 and 8. And then I found out, of course, Chris, that when I looked into this, this has been going on for decades. Our family law system, aside from the biases that we can talk about, it is basically perpetrating crimes against humanity. It's obfuscating the Constitution and our human rights. And it's making the American divorce machine nearly $60 billion a year. So we're incentivizing this.
And I know that obviously that the moms and dads are very important in a family. In fact, they are very important actually for the real well-being of the society, because you have to have that balance that the children can count on in life, as well as every other facet of their lives as well, besides family life at home. And it seems to be that we've got here a war between the sexes. And unfortunately, it seems that family court abuse seems to have been part of it.
Yes, I think what we've seen recently over the last few years is these public messages of smash the patriarchy and toxic masculinity and all men bad. And, you know, there has been we needed to have a conversation. We needed to advance the equity or the equality, I should say, of the sexes. And really, I look at this with regards to there are two different strains, as I would call it, strands of feminism. There are the women and men, because to be a feminist doesn't mean you have to be a woman. I support the female, the equality feminist, the empowerment feminist, who come from a place of championing and advocating women and mothers in the workplace, at home, in, you know, across society. I would like to think we're all in favor of that, but it's this radical strain of third and fourth wave feminism that decades ago decided to go on a tactical march stealthily and then in the press of smashing men, the father figure. And what we're seeing, of course, is, you know, the societal ills. We have the America is brilliant at many things. But when I found out that America, you know, is the world leader in children growing up in single-parent households, mm-hmm. Dad-deprived children, youths in prison, runaway children, adolescent patients in chemical abuse centers, the statistics are astonishing when you look at them. And there is a correlation here. If we don't have mothering and fathering, or at least have social programs that incentivize both the mother and the father, we're going to see more single-parent families. Mothers aren't getting the support they need. They may get financial help to a degree, but they're not getting the support from men and fathers. And when we have men and fathers who want to be present and have been present and loving, and the system is removing them like they did with me and like they have with thousands of other fathers across America, I think we have to have this Me Too dialogue, not just the Me Too monologue, and start having this conversation honestly.
We're talking with British actor, producer, author Greg Ellis. He has been known, at least, in fact, part of the title of his book, which is The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. He has been one sued in divorce court, who are people that are often called respondents. And you also, I understand, bring up in the book something which is called the six silver bullets of high conflict divorce, which we all know probably is about, 99 and 9/10% not what most divorce court cases involve. But you get these, unfortunately, like yours. Will you tell us about these six silver bullets in which you refer?
Sure. So I call it the silver bullet paradigm. What is a silver bullet? So a silver bullet is a simple, seemingly magical solution to a difficult problem. In this case, and in my book's case, the respondent, it's marriage disillusionment. So I also refer to it as the magic ballistics of family law. It's the ammunition for the smoking gun in the Wild West, the family law, if you will. It's the go-to playbook for divorce lawyers and petitioners, particularly in high-conflict divorces, because it guarantees success every time before you even go in court. And I think it speaks to the bigger societal issue as well of cry bullies and victim perpetrators. you know, victimhood has become the new social currency to a degree, and its economy's booming. And fakesters and hucksters and grifters and hoaxes being played out. We've seen what's happened with Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. We've seen what's happened with Jussie Smollett. You know, there is reward for being and playing the victim. And in divorce court, that reward is huge. It's massive for the petitioner. 80% of divorces are initiated by women. So, you know, for the most part, that's going to be women and mothers who are successful because they're the petitioner. They get the advantage of that's the person who files first in a disillusionment proceeding. And the outdated gender and sex roles still inside our courtrooms in family law, which see the mother as the major caregiver, in many instances the only caregiver. Look, there are men who are deadbeat, who aren't present, who obfuscate their responsibilities, who don't want to be fathers and aren't accountable, and they should be called out. But we should also call out the women and the mothers who are using this silver bullet, this go-to ruination super weapon that obliterates in a system that doesn't have, you know, family law is the only branch of our legal system that doesn't provide a presumption of innocence. There's no due process. There's no oversight. It's not answerable to the Supreme Court. So unless we have innocent or proven guilty, we see the burden of proof is on the accused. This is, you know, if you look at the statistics, it's predominantly men, predominantly fathers. And what you have then is, you know, we go back to the Salem witch trials and the Spanish Inquisition. That's what we've got in family law right now. So I'm trying to expose this cartel, and I call it a cartel because it is, in many instances, a crime syndicate. It's organized, it's targeted, it targets people's and families' estates, destroys families, and makes nearly $60 billion a year.
Mm-hmm. Now, your book is pretty strong, a pretty strong indictment, I guess, of what you could, I guess, call the divorce industry, certainly the way that family courts are handled these days in the United States. But you had a chance, I guess, to mention some important things that you've learned out of it, lessons you've learned out of it. Do you think there's any good that may have come out of what you had to deal with?
Well, what I wanted to do, you know, I've seen so many men and women, fathers and mothers, partners and parents go through the divorce courts, rinsed through the divorce courts in America and, frankly, in Canada. India, Australia, the UK, Europe, South America. This morning I was looking at a video from a documentary from South Africa. This is worldwide, but What have I learned? I didn't want to be, and I'm not, an angry, bitter ex. How do we arrive at that place individually? And what I wanted to do is actually from the phoenix of the ashes, like almost rise of phoenix movement or an organization. So the charitable extension of my book, The Respondent, which I've created, is called CPU, which stands for Children and Parents United. Mm-hmm. And we're developing programs to assist people, to promote and improve child well-being by providing information and resources to policymakers, legislatures, practitioners, and mainly the public, to result in enhanced relationships and reduced conflict for those children and parents navigating our current family law system.
British actor, producer, author Greg Ellis was married over 25 years ago, suddenly ended, and not the best way that some would certainly hope. And he's been able to take his own example and what he's learned over time to turn into a book, which is entitled The Respondent, Exposing the Cartel of Family Law. Greg, thank you very much for unfortunately having to dredge up some of the bad thoughts that you have had from your own personal experiences, but you're able to do it in a way that might show some, I guess, real possibility for reform to the family law system. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you, Chris. It's my pleasure. And hopefully we can improve the system and reform it and at the same time, in parallel, working through my charity, provide real immediate interventions into well-being for people who are stuck in the divorce trap or in the system. And I just want to say very quickly, if you're listening and you are and you feel helpless, you're not alone. You're not going crazy. The system is skewed. It drives you insane, but there is hope. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Students with disabilities face unique challenges during the pandemic, and it's still unclear what the long-term effects will be on special education students. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lee Gaines reports that many Indiana educators and families are worried about the pandemic's social and emotional toll on students with special needs.
Students are back to learning in person full time at the Independence Academy. That's a small private school in Indianapolis. They serve only about 40 students, all of whom are on the autism spectrum. Kate is one of them. She's a 15-year-old sophomore.
And I love the school, except but not with Zoom. Zoom was not my favorite.
Why didn't you like Zoom?
I just thought being in person is better, just for me, mentally and physically, because I like to be with people. I don't like seeing people on computers.
A group of middle school age students shared similar feelings. They preferred being in person, and not just because it was easier to learn that way.
And what's your name?
Christian.
Are you happy to be back in school?
Yep.
Why?
This school is awesome. I never had so many friends before.
Marissa Gill is the director of the Independence Academy. She says social and emotional learning is built into everything they do because students with autism need to know how to interact with the world to become independent adults.
That's critical to what we do here, just as critical as the academic piece. And our goal is our students are not isolated and that they're forming friendships and that they just their social interactions are strengthened. And so you're in a situation where that's not possible if they're remote.
Gill says the testing they've done so far indicates that students didn't lose a ton of academic skills during the pandemic. But she's seen some students' mental health decline, along with their behavior and social skills.
It's hard when you've worked so hard for something and you think, hey, we're past this and we're on to our next challenge. And then you realize, okay, we've got to backtrack here.
Gill's observations line up with Jess Dozen's experience. Dozen's son Mason is 10 years old. He has Down syndrome, and he goes to school in Hammond, a city in northwest Indiana. Dozen says virtual learning did not work for Mason.
It was absolutely horrible. And most of the time, like, you'd literally be, we'd be sitting in my dining room and we would be fighting. I'm trying to, like, hold him. And then I feel like a maniac because the teacher's probably like, why can't this kid listen to his mother? You know, like, you just feel terrible. Like, what are you supposed to do? And he's so stubborn.
Mason is back in school full time this year, and he's now getting occupational and speech therapy, services he didn't receive virtually. But Dozen still worries about the social opportunities Mason missed during the last year and a half.
Yeah, I know. I definitely know he's not going to get any of that time back. And I felt like he lost a ton. And it made him a little more stubborn, actually, too, because he got too used to us.
Dozen says Mason doesn't have any friends outside of school. It's the one place he can work on social skills. Sarah Hurwitz says that's common for students with disabilities. Hurwitz is an associate professor at Indiana University. She studies the effects of the pandemic on students like Mason.
They didn't get to work on social goals. And even when they were at school, the social distance requirements made it difficult to work on social skills. So they missed like a year and a half of social development that they really needed support with.
Hurwitz surveyed and interviewed special ed teachers at dozens of schools across Indiana. She asked them about their concerns for the future.
Everyone knows that there's going to be some academic implications of the pandemic, and the teachers know that. But what they're really the most concerned about were things beyond the academic disruptions, like behavior and social disruptions.
Hurwitz says we don't know how long it will take to get students back on track, both academically and socially. She says it will depend on the quality of their teachers and the ability of schools to provide services. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Gaines.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll speak with Leslie Plesak about last weekend's Sinai Forum speaker at Purdue University Northwest, a presentation that was done holographically as well as on Zoom. Hope you can join us for the conversation.